Welcome. Hola. Bienvenidos. Bonjour et bienvenue to the Social Network Show. Welcome to the only worldwide show dedicated to social networking and social media. We give you actionable information to make your social networking the best it can be for business to business, business to consumer, and for folks who just like to post. And now, broadcasting from the studios of the Hank Greenspoon School of Journalism and Media Studies of UNLV, the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, the host of the Social Network Show, Jim Nico, and Dr. Jane Kawaski.
Welcome to the Social Network Show. Today, you will be gathering thoughts and gaining insights from Dr. Joe Ulatowski and Nina Burley, our guests on the Social Network Show. This is Dr. Ulatowski's second visit with us. He is a visiting professor of philosophy at the University of Texas at El Paso and deputy editor of the Polish Journal of Philosophy. Dr. Ulatowski researches the nature of self and deception among members of social networks, and we'll be discussing this with you. In the second half of the show, we will welcome the author of an article that appeared in the October 2013 issue of Rolling Stone, Nina Burley.
September, to be exact.
September. No wonder it's no longer on the stands. Sexting, Shame, and Suicide, A Shocking Tale of Sexual Assault in the Digital Age. It's the story of Audrey Pott of Saratoga Hills High School in California. Well, now you have finally decided to take the plunge. You will try internet dating. You select what you've heard is a reputable site. Carefully craft your profile to present yourself honestly, but to best advantage. In a couple of days, you're pleasantly surprised by the number of replies. Happily, that allows you to be careful and selective, but still end up with a date or two. Now there's someone that's easy on the eyes and is gainfully employed in a respectable profession. So far, so good. Following advice on safety, you answer via email. Conversation flows easily, and after daily exchanges over a week or two, you agree to a phone call. Calls go well. It's hard not to want to talk several times a day. Another week flies by, yet you feel you've known this person forever. But wisely, you arrange to meet in person at a public place, so if things take a turn for the worse, you have an exit strategy. The coffee shop is close to your neighborhood, and there's your day. Wow. Even better looking than the picture. And those eyes. Let's snuggle. No, of course not. Let's take it nice and easy. Besides, there is one thing you want to clear up. A small flag of indeterminate color waving easily on a slight breeze. You say, you know, when I asked you on the phone where you were from, you said you were from the island of Kona? That's right. Comes the abrupt, somewhat irritated reply. But, you know, I've been to Hawaii a number of times, and Kona, it's a city on the island of Hawaii. Uh-oh. A look of embarrassment, a dullness of those previously sparkling eyes. Oh, no, don't tell me. Well, actually, I'm from the Philippines, not Hawaii, as I told you. Any other confessions you want to know? Well, I'm not an investment banker. Actually, I'm a teller in training. And I had to meet you on Thursday because on Friday, I'm not attending a banking conference. That's when I attend a couple finance courses at the U. One, two, three strikes, you're out. You explain that you don't like to be lied to. You say good evening, throw some bills on the table, and walk out. By the way, this is a true story. It was one of Trisha Ventker's Internet Dates from Hell, told in her book by that name. Today, Dr. Ulatowski is with us to discuss lying and deception of self and others. Welcome to the Social Network Show, Professor.
Thank you very much for having me, Dr. J and Jim. Appreciate you having me invite me back.
We're so glad you're here, man. It's always a pleasure to have your brilliant mind in gear.
Now, ethics is a subfield of philosophy, and Joe, I understand you've been working on issues related to lying and self-deception. Can you tell us something about that as it applies to life online?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, the example you gave is a good one, where cases of online dating, it turns out that the person who has been texting you, who has been emailing you, et cetera, after having met on this or through this online dating service, turns out not to be the person you had once thought they were once you meet them in person. It's actually an excellent example of just straight up deception and lying. But the way that we in philosophy, for lack of better definition, call deception something like this is that it's the point where we, in other words, as a person, get others to believe someone or something when we truly believe that its opposite is true or something other than what that something happened to be as true. And in the case that you gave, I think it's a case that it's a moral wrong, right? You've harmed this other person who had thought so much, so highly of you prior to the actual meeting in the coffee shop, so to speak.
So you know that if I'm lying, I know that what I'm saying is false and I'm misleading the person.
Right, yeah. I mean, intentionally misleading a person in the case that you'd given is a very bad thing. And because you've harmed the relationship that had been built, right, over the course of perhaps maybe several weeks, at the very least, several exchanges online. And so when you'd met up, it was completely different than you'd anticipated. Interestingly enough, however, there's something that I should mention, too, is that deception isn't always a bad thing in terms of moral harm. It actually is, in some ways, enhancing to relationships.
Mm-hmm. Could you explain that, please?
All right. So, yeah. So I obviously have to explain myself in that sense. So let's take a classic example, not necessarily from the virtual world to start, but rather from the real-time world, okay? And it's the following. Think of how you build friendships and build trust among friends. Sometimes what it's a good idea to do as a part of this building trust and building friendships is to play a practical joke or a prank on them, deceive them intentionally. And here is what results is that, I mean, I'm not talking about the kinds of practical jokes or pranks which are harmful, like really a bad practical jokes that that hurt people, whether emotionally or physically.
Okay.
But I'm talking about something like a snipe hunt, okay, if you've ever heard that term, right? And here's the thing, is that once it's revealed to the victim that it was a practical joke or a prank, the realization by the so-called victim in this case, right, is that you trusted the bond that you'd had as a friend, right, to start enough to play a trick on them. And in that sense, the trust in the bond had been enhanced. And in fact, you've grown closer in that sense.
What would be an example, Joe? I mean, what a snipe. I don't even know what it means, but just give me a quick example. I'm sorry, I'm ignorant.
We obviously have to watch the movie Up, which is on our list.
What would be an example of a snipe?
Well, a snipe hunt actually is the following: is that you? I had this trick played on me. In fact, they say let's go snipe hunting. You need X, Y, Z. Say a bow and arrow or something like that, or something to kill the snipe. Yeah, to capture the snipe. And you go out on this long journey, say out in Las Vegas, go out to Red Rocks, and I feel like this is the environment in which the snipe would exist. And you're basically the person who doesn't know what a snipe is looking for some kind of animal or something, right, that's called a snipe. And then it turns out that after a while what they do is the people run to the car and jump in the car and then drive away. Of course, they don't drive all the way away, but they're like the person who is the victim is like, wait, what's going on, and the people eventually come back and say, ha-ha, there's no such thing as snipes.
Well, there wasn't until today, but I'm going to invent snipes, and you will get a full disclosure on that very quickly.
Okay.
Back to Dr. J.
Okay. So I'm assuming that you felt closer to these people because of that. But if we think about it online,
right.
what you know, it just seems bizarre to me that someone would think that knowing that they're going to eventually meet these people in person, to put right. up a 20-year-old photo or, you know, something that misrepresents them. Do you have any thoughts on what would lead a person to do such a thing, knowing that they're eventually going to be revealed as great a liar?
Question. That's a great question, Dr. Jim.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely a great question. Yeah, you know, that is a worry we should have, particularly about, you know, about the doctored photos. I mean, in the sense that, you know, you're not going to be the same person or look the same way as you do in that, say, photograph. And especially if you deliberately doctor the photo to make it look, say, younger, or, you know, you airbrush it. I mean, there's all these techniques in terms of Photoshop, using Photoshop, right, to doctor your photographs and whatnot. That certainly seems to be a moral harm if, in fact, the victim, the other person, I should say, you know, expected someone who looked more like the airbrushed photograph. Is it, you know, and a lot of people think that this is not necessarily as common as we might think. And in fact, it's hard not to deceive others on virtual networks, so especially, like, well, as you say, profile photos, right? I mean, think that profile photos are kind of an interesting example, whether on Twitter, Facebook, or what other virtual network you have. Because here's the thing. We're living in an age where we're taking literally hundreds, if not thousands, of photographs, either of ourselves or of others, on a daily basis. And we choose, right, the photograph that we think is most appealing not only to us, but we also assume to others. So in that sense, we don't even have to doctor a photograph. We technically doctor photographs in the amount of photographs that we take. So we really can't help but deceive others, even in something as mundane as say, posting a particular profile photo to represent us as individuals.
Well, it's sort of cherry picking to present your best, your presentation of self in everyday life online. Let's talk more about that in terms of the results, what the consequences are of that when we resume our conversation with Dr. Joe Ulatowski.
Questions? Comments? Email us at questions@thesocialnetworkshow.com. We'll be right back.
Kelly Keller, an intellectual property attorney specializing in internet law and social media issues. Join me on The Kelly Keller Show right here on the Social Network Station. Together with my guests, we will tackle tough legal problems presented by the ever-increasing use of social media in everyday business. Through dynamic conversations, we will discuss your rights and responsibilities in the new media world so the hard work you have put into developing your brand, business, and products does not go to waste. How does the law's response to the social media explosion affect you? Join me on The Kelly Keller Show to learn more.
Now, back to The Social Network Show.
Welcome back to today's Social Network Show, talking with Joe Ulatowski from University of Texas El Paso, a philosopher and an ethicist that is interested in online behavior. So we've been talking about deception, self-deception maybe, too.
Well, Joe, Jim Nico here. A couple things. Last time we talked, you talked about even back as far as like anonymity online, going back as far as possibly even the pre-Socratics, at least Plato, et cetera. And brilliant insights there. I might have tossed in the pre-Socratics just to, you know, because I like Heraclitus. But anyway, the point is, the real point is that thank you for that, because people have been playing wearing masks forever, all through history. Eyes Wide Shut with Tom Cruise and his former wife, Nicole Kidman. Fascinating expose into the underworld of sexual escapades. And Anonymous, they wore masks to the ball. Here's a quick question, and I don't know that we'll cover it all this time, but in law, as you know, there are different levels of penalty phases and sentencing for the following. When a crime is premeditated with malice and aforethought. Okay. So I would think in this atmosphere, and first of all, I love your insights about where deception can play a useful role. And it's almost like the dance, you know, the dance between people getting to know each other in courtship and stuff like that, that kind of thing. But when it comes right down to the very dangerous level of where we have kids online and they're being deceived by predators that are trying to manipulate them into doing sexual favors, et cetera, do you see that premeditation, malice, and aforethought can really, I mean, we know it's a moral harm, but can you talk to the why, maybe, of why people allow themselves to get that far down in the evilness, if you will? Is there any concepts there for us?
Oh, right, yeah. I mean, you're pointing at a very deeply troubling part of in terms of the intentional action. Like, what, I mean, any action that appears to be intentional, right, by its perpetrator is going to be treated differently than just an ordinary action. So, the predator, right, the sexual predator online, right, is intending to deceive his or her victim, right, in order to gain something, right, which we would consider a harm. I mean, on all accounts, you know, much like, as you say, the distinction between first-degree murder and manslaughter, just to kind of widen the scope a little bit, rather than second-degree murder and such. You know, the person who commits murder with intent is going to be and ought to be treated differently than the person who maybe it was just merely an accident, quote unquote. In the sense that it wasn't intentionally done. So I think that in these cases, yeah, this is a sticky issue. It's not very clear. I mean, once you really look at what we understand as an intentional action, right, given that our intentions are private, right, in the sense that I can't jump into another person's head, I can merely interpret whether or not someone performed an action intentionally or unintentionally,
right,
on the basis of some kind of external assessment, right? I literally just can't jump into a person's head. And so this is what's most troubling, right, for philosophers in particular, coming to terms with the intentionality of action. And it's hard to do because, of course, these things are private in the sense that they're held within one person's head. And,
but don't you think that in the case of, for instance, a lot of the online harassment and so forth, that any reasonable person, as the law tends to say, would expect certain behavior to be harmful, and that it just stretches the imagination to think that the perpetrator didn't realize that what they were doing was going to be harmful? And if they do realize it and they go ahead and do it, how can that not be intentional?
Right. Yeah. So this is okay. Good. Okay. This is something actually I've in preparation for the show, I had kind of thought about, in particular, the cyber bullies, right?
Mm-hmm.
This is a case where I'm beginning to think, and I have to go through cases a little bit more carefully with these cyber bullies to get a sense of it, that this is a case of self-deception, right? And the following sense is that you know, clearly they've done a moral harm. Let's just make sure we've got that clear, okay?
Mm-hmm.
But here's the thing. I'm imagining that the cyberbully also believes that harming that person, right, the cyberbully,
mm-hmm.
right, believes that harming me, the cyberbully, right, is a very bad thing. Which and also, not only that, but harming others is a bad thing, right, a moral harm, okay? But by the same token, they also uphold this other belief, okay, that says that, well, I guess I can engage in these harmful behaviors online. This is an inconsistency. It's actually a contradiction, right, in the sense that you can't uphold the belief that it's wrong to harm myself and others while also at the same time harming someone else or even myself in the case of the cyberbully. Okay?
Right, because they for some reason think that all the same rules don't apply when you're online.
Right, absolutely. There is this additional dimension, right, which is the virtual versus real-time world. I know we got into this last time, but there is this distinction that, yeah, literally it's almost as if their views change of harm, right? There's harm online and there's harm real-time or something to that effect. And they're harming others online is perhaps distinct from harming others in real time. And maybe that's where the deception, maybe this is where the inconsistencies in one's deceiving of oneself, they convince themselves that they've relieved themselves of this contradiction.
Right. So it is now a societal need to impress upon young people particularly, I suppose, but all people, that there is that cyberspace is real. This is real life. It's not
right.
It's not something else. And that is what we want to focus on what can we promote in the world is extending personal responsibility to the online world. And we're very grateful for your insights on this. And we've been speaking with Dr. Joe Ulatowski from the University of Texas, Utah.
Want to be a guest on The Social Network Show? Email us at guest@thesocialnetworkshow.com. We'll be right back.
Today in school, I learned a lot. In chemistry, I learned that no one likes me. In biology, I learned that I'm fat and stupid. In English, I learned that I'm disgusting. And in gym, I learned that I'm pathetic and a joke. The only thing I didn't learn in school today is why no one ever helps.
Kids witness bullying every day. They want to help, but they don't know how. Teach them how to stop bullying and be more than a bystander at stopbullying.gov. A message from the Ad Council.
Now, back to The Social Network Show.
Welcome to The Social Network Show. And we are speaking with Ms. Nina Burley, who writes on a variety of topics for her column in the New York Observer. The additional writing she's done has been for Rolling Stone, Business Week, The New Yorker, Time, New York, New York Times, and she's appeared on many television shows such as Good Morning America and Nightline. Nina is an adjunct professor at Columbia Graduate School of Journalism. In her book titled Mirage, Napoleon's Scientists and the Unveiling of Egypt was chosen by the New York Times as an editor's choice and won the Society of Women Educators Award in 2008. Welcome to the Social Network Show, Nina.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here. And thank you for that lovely introduction. You did, though, leave out my last book, which is on the Amanda Knox trial, and that was a New York Times bestseller, and it has a social network aspect.
It does.
So bring that up at another time, but there's a lot of internet activity around that case.
Right, and she was the American in Italy that was arrested for a murder, correct?
Yes, exactly, and jailed for 4 years.
Oh, wow.
And I was reading one of the reviews. I mean, the reviews on that book in particular are astounding in that, what we got from the mainstream press online, et cetera, I mean, on television and various ways, was just not anywhere near what you presented in your book. So I can't wait to read your book. And we certainly want to delve into what you think in terms of after your Rolling Stone article, too, you know, to whatever extent you think it's pertinent.
Well, that the name of that book is The Fatal Gift of Beauty, The Italian Trials of Amanda Knox. Okay, so the article that you wrote that appeared in September, Rolling Stone, was called Sexting, Shame, and Suicide, A Shocking Tale of Sexual Assault in the Digital Age. What wrote you, led you to write that piece, Nina?
Well, I mean, similar to the thing that led me to get interested in the Amanda Knox case, which is, it's a passion of mine to kind of watch what's happening to young girls in the media portrayal of young women, and what's happening to young women, young girls, as they become independent.
Interesting.
Whether the world is as perilous for them or less perilous than it used to be.
That's interesting because I believe the last text that the subject of your article wrote was, you don't know what it's like to, you have no idea what it's like to be a girl.
Absolutely. That is one of the lines in the Facebook messaging that she was engaged in the last week of her life before she took her life.
Nina, Jim Nico here. A quick aside. You're talking to someone here. I spent 20 years approximately as a crisis intervention expert. A lot of my work was on call. For example, when someone, a girl was cutting at her wrists, I was called and then I would do an intervention and work with them. One of the things that jumped off the page on Rolling Stone, what you wrote about, this part here, which is, it's a scary thought for me, but I've been expecting it. High school epidemic, sexting, shame, and suicide, and then, of course, your article. The thing about, the reason I brought up my experience is because in the old days, they're used, and even now, in a clinical treatment setting, whether we're working with dual diagnosis or the mentally ill, there's what might be called a Mayday button, which ironically enough is being used by Amazon now for customer service. But what I mean by that is when a girl would be cutting herself and or suicidal, and she could call an 800 number and they'd patch her right through to me and I would do crisis intervention work right then and there, I could make a contract with that girl to go in and see her therapist. And it was a very powerful tool. We don't have that online. I mean, for example, in the case of Audrey Pott, it just seems to me, and you correct me if your experience contradicts mine, but there's a big breakdown in communication. You know, some of the suicidal ideation is being totally missed with these girls. What, do you have anything on that?
Well, you know, this girl's fellow students, I mean, you know, here's what happened. I mean, let's just say outright what happened. This is a girl, Audrey Pott, who had had some sort of minor bullying issues from junior high on. She developed breasts very early, so she was like the object of a lot of boy attention in the context of what teenagers, young teenagers do now, which is they send selfies and do these, you know, pictures of themselves, and girls were sending pictures around, and boys were insisting on pictures of these girls, even in seventh grade. And so she came out of this background in this affluent community right outside Cupertino, where they make the phones that are, you know, incapacitate this, make capable the children taking pictures like this. She came out of that background, and she had some, you know, kind of typical teenage girl issues, body image issues, where she thought she was fat. She had big breasts. She had a lot of issues around, you know, eating, but she wasn't openly suicidal. She wasn't at the point where the parents felt like she needed to get therapy. You know, she had, you know, sort of her share of issues, but not over the top. But what happened was, a week before she committed suicide, she was at a party with, in a parentless house, and, you know, typical teen shenanigans. She's 15. These 15-year-old kids are just starting out partying. They drink too much. They're making vodka Gatorades, cocktails, and drinking the tequila out of the parental liquor cabinet. She gets completely blotto. Three boys that she's known from junior high carry her up to her bedroom, lock the door. She's out unconscious. They strip or half strip her. They draw all over her body graffiti with Sharpie. Then they do sexual things to her. They take photographs of some of the action, and then they leave. She wakes up the next morning, half dressed, covered with ink, not knowing what happened to her. She then spends the rest of the week trying to, first of all, ascertain what happened, and secondly, begging these boys not to share photographs that they had taken. This is all happening on Facebook, on cell phone texting, and there were students, many students were aware of it. That's why you're reading those, you just quoted that line. That's one that's part of a Facebook message chat session that she had with one of the boys. Girlfriends knew that she was having problems, buddies knew, but I don't think anybody knew to the extent of it, and certainly her parents just thought, well, she's just a moody teenager. She's been a moody teenager, you know, in the last week of her life. She was not, they didn't see anything out of, they knew she was troubled, but they didn't see anything where they felt like they had to call in outside help.
Thank you, Nina. So in essence then, the usual signs the usual pre-signs of suicidal ideation are, in your experience at least, or observation, are they absent in cases like this? There were no warnings. There was no discussion. You know what I mean, toward the end? I know it happened very quickly. I get that.
I didn't, from my interviews with the friends and the parents,
okay,
I did not pick up anything,
okay,
that they had gotten any indication that she was suicidal ideation.
That's interesting.
Suicidal ideation. Now, one of the friends did tell me that at some point in the past, there had been some, like way back, like when she was in seventh grade, there had been some attempt made or discussion of an attempt. And whether the parents knew about this or not, I don't know. They didn't mention it to me. It was one kid who said it, and then that was it. Now, the reason that, you know, we didn't delve too deeply into the suicidal ideation thing is that our story, the focus of the reporting, was on the act itself of, with these juvenile boys who are now, you know, charged and have pled, at least some of them, to sex assault. What they did was the triggering event, and, you know, that they did this thing to her, and that this is a very common thing happening in high schools all over the country, where boys are not understanding boundaries. They think they're pranking girls by gang assaulting them when they're drunk. They take pictures as a sort of trophy, and then they pass them around. And it's done in the context of the larger context of high school kids with technology, sexting, and sex taking place in this context of technology. And so that was the point of the story. It wasn't that could people have headed off this particular suicide. It's about this larger issue of boys, boundaries, and technology. And the girl, Audrey's suicide, you know, as her father said, 100 girls could have this happen to them, and one commits suicide. It's not a common response to it. But that is, the point of it is, that the triggering event was that event. It was that set her over the edge.
And the fact that it doesn't necessarily result in suicide doesn't decrease the seriousness of the situation.
Absolutely not.
Why is this considered acceptable to this point? Is there no concept of the humiliation that it is exposing these girls to? It really makes me feel like we have made no progress in terms of respect for women. But tell me,
the number of rapes, and this is in the story, the number of rapes is astonishing. I mean, they say like 1 in 5 girls are sex assaulted in America, and the daily number is unbelievable. But it hasn't increased since we were in high school. This is something, and the girls who are most at risk are high school and college age. But it hasn't increased, they don't think. What's happened is there's this whole technological image-taking ability that didn't exist before. And so this thing has a double side to it. It has the one side, it's shaming these girls. It's causing them, some of them, to drop out of school. It's causing untold amounts of pain because it's carrying forward the act into perpetuity. The flip side of it is that all of a sudden, prosecutors and police have evidence that they didn't used to have because girls wouldn't go forward with it. So now they have this evidence. And that's what's happened in Steubenville. That's what's happening in Missouri right now, where this family, I mean, it's an unbelievable story. Google Maryville, Missouri, where these girls, a 12 and a 13-year-old, gang raped, dropped in their mother's lawn. The boys videotaped it, and the mother moved out of town to get away from what they call slut shaming that was going on, mm-hmm. and the house was burned down after they left. That's how the community responded. But because they have video, the prosecutors and the cops in the town have been kind of forced to deal with it in a way that they wouldn't have had before.
Okay, well, let's take that up in our next segment, and we'll talk more about some of the consequences, why the technological abilities make the consequences much more grave than in previous times.
Hear archived shows at thesocialnetworkshow.com. Follow us on Twitter at @SocialNetShow or TSN Station. The Social Network Show will be right back.
Today in school, I learned a lot. In chemistry, I learned that no one likes me. In biology, I learned that I'm fat and stupid. In English, I learned that I'm disgusting. And in gym, I learned that I'm pathetic and a joke. The only thing I didn't learn in school today is why no one ever helps.
Kids witness bullying every day. They want to help, but they don't know how. Teach them how to stop bullying and be more than a bystander at stopbullying.gov. A message from the Ad Council.
Now, back to the Social Network Show.
Jim Nico here on the Social Network Show with Dr. J and Nina Burley. And here we are. We are in the very midst of the essence of the problem of danger online for especially young girls and women. Basically, Nina, thank you again for your insights. Could you talk a little bit? Now, you've written this article. You've been on the cutting edge of what's been going on as we've added this super fast hyper technology, the internet, to what used to be just growing pains. Okay. What would you say? What's going on now about what we should do? What do you think we should do?
Well, there are a couple things. I mean, first of all, this all starts, the best thing is for it to be starting at home. Parents should be snooped. They should know what is going on their kids' phones. I tell my son, 14-year-old, you know, I pick it up every once in a while and read his text, and he gets angry, and I said, we own this phone, and you understand why I need to know what's going on with you, because he knows I've been covering this story for months and months. And you talk to them about what's appropriate, what's not. These naked picture things that these kids are engaged in, that's child porn. It's considered child porn in almost every single state in the country. They can get in trouble for that. Parents can get in trouble for it if they're passing around naked girl pictures on their phones and these kids are under 18. You can hear it happen in New York in my own son's school, and the Bronx DA came in and went after the parents for child porn on a computer. So that's one thing. The parents need to be alert, aware, vigilant, talking to the kids, talking. And I know it's really uncomfortable. I have to do it myself. I don't like to do it. They think I'm completely paranoid, but you have to keep bringing it up. Secondly, schools. In this story, the sexting, the naked girl pictures, the above-the-waist pictures, were being asked for by boys in seventh grade, and the girls were complying already. Unbeknownst to the parents, the entire class of girls said the entire class had already done this before they even got out of middle school. They had sent pictures of themselves, bra or no bra. That's what they were asked for. Send a picture, bra or no bra, and they take up above the waist pictures and email them to each other. The schools need to have this conversation with them in classroom setting when they're teaching sex ed or whatever else in a civics class. They need to say, one, this is it's inappropriate. You can't do it. Here are the reasons why. And two, let's have the conversation about girls and boundaries. And what is it? What is a prank and what is sex assault? It's never explained to them, so they don't know. And all they know is that they're in this hypersexualized world where you've got Miley Cyrus and, you know, scantily clad and naked MTV and porn that's one click away or two clicks away from when you look for stuff on Taylor Swift. You can come on a porn within two clicks of that. Your kids are exposed to and very degrading porn, very degrading to the female. That's the world we live in. So the schools need to bring it up. They need to have this conversation. And then thirdly, there needs to be a law enforcement aspect, because the law enforcement, for example, in Saratoga, this is in Silicon Valley, so San Jose, California, they need to have these conversations with the schools. They need to have the tools with which to deal with the new reality. And in California, they did pass recently a law where they are allowing students to request Facebook and some of these other servers, social networks, to remove pictures that they don't want to have, that they regret putting up. They have to have the right to take them down and say, I want that down, I want it off. So that is now a law in California, and it's also being discussed in Europe. They call it, I think, I have the right to erase or something law, and it's for adults as well. And these companies, Google, they have to take down what you want off. The problem with that is the way the internet works, and this has been discussed on, it's a First Amendment issue, for one thing. Once it's up, it's passed around. And so, you know, you can tell Google to take it down, but it might be somewhere else. It's already, like, moved around. If it's gone viral, you can just forget it. So to put that restriction on, then you get into this hornet's nest of, like, well, who else is going to be liable for this? And you know, apparently, like, a Facebook like is a First Amendment protected speech. So, you know, you get this kind of privacy versus First Amendment thing going on at the legal level, which is really complicated. So putting that aside, someday they're going to have to deal with all this. So But putting that aside, you have to start with the parents, and the schools have got to get up to speed with it because it's a fact of life, and it happens in the school setting.
Okay, thank you, Nina. That's, first of all, we really appreciate the practical advice there. We had on a gentleman from MIT and on the cutting edge of the media lab there. And one of the things he said, which I thought was very powerful and maybe a fifth tool maybe or a sixth tool, is that, you know, in the sense of like Gmail, for example, I don't know to what extent my Gmail is read, but the fact that things I write about in Gmail or any email seem to come up on ads. So in the targeting sense, one thing that he said, this was interesting. He said, basically, we have the tools that if someone is online and using certain words, a pop-up could come up and said, hey, you're going over the line, or are you having suicidal thoughts, or you're becoming a bully, or whatever. I mean, like Amazon's using this technology right now. So pop-ups could come up and be suggestive, too. I think that's something that, regardless of the complicated laws or the First Amendment rights, we could get help, you know, a help button. Do you think?
Well, you know, that just sounds so scarily Big Brotherish to me. I mean, already these ads are creepy. And to have that, I mean, I don't know what the future holds. We are in such a brave new world as far as surveillance and what people know about you and where privacy, you know, where it ends. You know, does it end when you turn your computer on? Does it end when you turn the, you know, Wi-Fi on and start going on Google? It's unbelievable what they can find out. And I would be where do you draw the line? Okay, now we know that you're talking about cocaine. So, bing, you know, can you have the police there? I mean, you know, there are all of these Fourth Amendment issues with that, right?
Yes, that's a good point.
So I don't know. I mean, I theoretically it's a great idea to have like an online psychiatric assistance thing going on. I mean, if they're going to do it to have you buy goods, you might as well have other uses for it, right?
Well, yeah, yeah. And that's the idea.
I personally, I just think the whole thing is very creepy, and I don't know. I mean,
the problem.
There's probably other better ways to do it, but you know, we'll see.
Yeah, there are ways of improving the situation. The unfortunate thing seems to be that the people with the ability to do that, for instance, report buttons, are very complicated. They're different for each type of post, for instance, on Facebook. And when people report things, usually they're told, oh, this doesn't violate our community standards, even when it's obviously violating human decency standards, and in terms of harassing people and so forth. There are threats, there are death threats, etc. We try to promote responsible ownership of social network online. And that when you have a electronic playground that someone who is making a great deal of profit off of providing this needs to have some sort of safety considerations.
Absolutely,
because they are liable.
They aren't all liable. That's the thing. I mean,
they should be.
In the FCC, there's a law. There's a federal law that gives them a pass.
Right, the Section 230.
Section 230.
Yeah.
Right. You know what it is. And there has been some discussion by some of these experts that I talked to. Lori Andrews, who's wonderful at the University of Illinois, Kent in Chicago.
Right.
The Law and Technology Center, where she says, you know, maybe there should be some. A responsibility written into this. So if you're getting that 230 pass, like a Facebook or a server, that you are getting that pass, but in exchange for that pass, you have to put in certain restrictions, and that would be one of them. That's, you know, you're harassing somebody. You're using, you know, the revenge porn, or you're putting up pictures of teenagers, girlfriends, or whatever. That you are to not do that and not to allow that to be happening. Then you get your 230.
Or, charge a premium that if they don't want to do it, someone else has to do it, well, they should be paid for that. We have people that we have associated with our blog, for instance, Trista Hendren, that had the rape book page on Facebook out of sheer frustration that there was no response to the reports. So they found that they had to do mass reporting to get Facebook to pay any attention to the...
Fantastic. What a hero she is.
Yeah.
That. I didn't know that. After you connected me, we've connected on Twitter, but I didn't realize that she was this. That's wonderful. Congratulations
yes.
to her and to you for your involvement in that.
Well, and I wanted to just add real quick, if I may, is Carol Todd, Amanda Todd's mom, who committed suicide October 10th, 2012, is on our board of advisors, and Trista Hendren now at thegirlgodbook.com. Or at the Girl God Book on Twitter is also on our board. So thank you for that.
Great.
Thank you.
Yeah.
The irony of all of that is that, you know, the people involved in the rape book page, eventually it was very grueling work, very difficult work, and they started getting threats of all kinds. Even their children were targeted. And All of this they were doing for nothing. And they're thinking, wait a minute, you know, does Facebook need charity? Do they need somebody to volunteer time to do their job?
Unbelievable.
So it's pretty absurd. And hopefully that is going to penetrate the public consciousness soon and demand some changes.
One thing also, Nina, I want to tell you about is Trista Hendren, who's now doing a series on the Social Network Show with us, and brilliant in her own right. She and I started a forum on our blog, which is, and by the way, we want to get your contact information, but this is something I would certainly invite you to, or anyone that you know. It's thesocialnetworkstation.com/blog. And what we're doing, or what Trista's doing with us, is bringing in thought leaders, as they call them, to give their opinion on these very questions we're asking. What should social networks do? What have been your experiences on these networks? And it's called The Good, the Bad, and the Horrifying on Social Networks. So I'll send you a link, and we'd love to invite you there if you have the time. And Dr. J?
Thank you.
You're welcome.
So this is it's a fascinating field, because we really are at a change point in society. I've heard the development of electronic communication being compared to the development of atomic energy and the atomic bomb. That's how crucial it is to human life on the planet. And we are struggling to find out how to deal with it, but especially to apply the wisdom or the progress that we have made, hopefully, in the physical world and law, to realize that this is not a world apart. Online life is real life, and there needs to be just as much civility and law and order amongst people communicating online as there is face-to-face or over the telephone.
Absolutely. Well said.
Well, we really appreciate your joining us. And this has been Nina Burley, author of Sexting, Shame, and Suicide, and a wonderful report on the tragedy of Audrey Pott in Saratoga, California, and also author of a book about Amanda Knox, what was it called again?
Fatal Gift of Beauty.
Yeah.
That's a brilliant title. I love that. I'm going to get that book.
Thank you. I recommend it. I mean, I feel I've written 5 books, and that's the one where so far as I can tell, it's the best one I've written. So I hope that you will have a look at it.
Okay.
Maybe
sounds
we can
like...
talk about it. It has a social media aspect, a strong one.
Mm-hmm. Nina.
Because there was a witch hunt. An online witch hunt has been going on.
Okay. Well, yes, yeah. Let's do that. We'll schedule another talk with you on that topic.
Yeah, if we can, we'd love to have you back. And also, in the meantime, what is the best place to get a hold of you online, please?
Oh, you can definitely just go to my website, www.ninaburleigh.com. That's NINABURLEIGH.com.
Okay.
NinaBurleigh.com, and that has a all my work and ways to buy the books, and also to email me directly.
We know when a show is going well when time flies. Nina, you're an amazing guest, and yes, we'd be honored to have you back again and talk about whatever
Thank
you want.
Thank you so much.
You've been listening to The Social Network Show, the only worldwide show dedicated to social networking and social media, coming to you from the studios of the Hank Greenspan School of Journalism and Media Studies of UNLV, the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. Listen to archived shows and follow us on Twitter. The views expressed on The Social Network Show are those of the hosts and guests and may not be the views of Social Network Intermedia. The Social Network Show is produced by Social Network Intermedia, copyright 2012.